All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I am your host, Aaron Freeman, and today we are breaking down the Falcons quarterback position, talking about the battles and storylines centering on this position group heading into training camp.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, founder of FalcFans.com, one of the longest-running Falcon websites on the internet. On Twitter, at FalcFans, and of course, the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. I'm feeling a little bit under the weather, coming down with a cold. Hopefully you guys, you know, generally speaking, when I say that and then listen back to the podcast, it's like a 4% difference in the quality. So it's mostly imperceptible, but I do want to say that at the top, just in case it becomes an issue, you know. I sound more like a mouth breather, literal mouth breather, just simply because I can't breathe out of my nose. Today. So, that being said, you know, we're still going to break down this position group, but you know, I have the hunger, the sickness, I can't stop. You know, I could be up in the hospital and I'd still be recording this podcast if that was a possibility. So today we're going to talk about this cornerback group. This is an interesting position group because the Falcons are only really bringing 7 corners to camp, and likely going to keep 5, if not 6 of them. So you're really, in terms of like positional bat, unlike most other positions where there's going to be multiple players cut, there might only be one guy cut this year among this cornerback group. And honestly, there is a scenario where if the Falcons enter the week one with, you know, multiple injuries at this group, they might keep 7 corners on the roster going into week one, just so they can have enough bodies. So, you know, this is unique among this group where, you know, at least pretty much every other position group, there's probably going to be at least one or two cuts, maybe quarterback and obviously special teams. We'll talk about that later. But that's what's interesting about this group. You know, I think let's start backwards on the depth chart. Really, the battle is going to be, if we're talking, it's going to be for that last spot, that potential 6th spot, which is going to be Leon McFadden versus Bleedy Ray Wilson. We didn't really get to see a whole lot of Leon McFadden last year for the final 4 games of the season when he was on the roster. I'll be honest, I don't know much about him besides what I've read about him and what I've seen on paper. You know, he hasn't really played a whole lot since his rookie season with the Browns back in 2013. I know he's been productive on special teams. I know he can play in the slot. I know he's not particularly big. But other than that, he wasn't a guy that I necessarily felt compelled to go back and try to dig through to find the 150 snaps that he's played over the last 3 years combined to try to figure out who he is as a player. My assumption is, you know, he's climbing the uphill battle here between him and Bleedy Ray Wilson, but I also think that the Falcons wouldn't have re-signed him if they just saw him purely as a camp body. You know, I think most likely Bleedy Ray will win that 6th spot. I think his ability to play inside, outside, as well as the fact that he was functional on special teams last year as a gunner, replacing C.J. Goodwin down the stretch after he got cut after that Vikings game. I think the fact that he played particularly well in that Vikings game when he saw action shows, you know, indicates a relative level of trust from the coaching staff that they know if push comes to shove, they can put him out there and be reasonably confident that they can get decent production from that spot as a, you know, potential 4th corner. I think what's going to be interesting is, you know, you look ahead of him in the depth chart, you have Justin Bethel sort of, you know, plugged in for that 5th spot on the depth chart. But I wouldn't say Bethel is a lock to make the roster, but I think he's pretty close to a lock. I would be very surprised if he did make the roster just because of his special teams value. I think that's really the primary motivation of why the Falcons signed him, because if I'm being honest, I think when you watch his play, particularly last season as a cornerback, you're not particularly impressed. I don't think there's any reason to look at him in that regard as a defensive player and say he's an upgrade over Bleedy Ray Wilson, you know, or whatever I assume Leon McFadden's level to be. I don't think he's significantly better at that. And I think, you know, part of the reason why I was very happy to see the Falcons draft a player like Isaiah Oliver or really any cornerback this year is because I didn't want the Falcons to be one twisted ankle away from Justin Bethel being their nickel cornerback if he was going to be the fourth guy. But now with the addition of Oliver, he's sort of pushed down the depth chart as the fifth guy. And we'll see what he does. Like, I don't have the highest opinion of Bethel's ability in coverage. I expect him to get some work on defense this year, but it wouldn't shock me if that number is, you know, if we're talking about snap counts, we're talking about like 50, 60, you know, less than 80 snaps this year, which is comparable to what we saw with Deji Olatoye these last couple of years. And, you know, that's primarily Olatoye's playing time was primarily driven when there were multiple injuries at the cornerback position, like we saw with Trufant 2 years ago. So we'll see what Bethel does. You know, like he's fine, but like, I think special teams is really why he's here. So even, you know, I think the reason why I say that is even if he sort of struggles in the preseason this year, based off of my assessment of his skill level, which is a decent possibility, I don't think it's really going to hurt his chances to make the team. So we'll see what happens with him. But I think, you know, primarily it's really about the top four guys. And we're going to talk about two of those guys, and Brian Poole and Isaiah Oliver, in just a moment. But I do want to plug LockedOnSports.com, your one-stop hub for the Locked On Podcast Network, where you can find content related to the Major League Baseball, NFL, and NBA. Again, LockedOnSports.com, your team every day. So the most compelling battle at this quarterback position is going to really be between Brian Poole and Isaiah Oliver for that nickel job. And I should be clear here, guys, when I say nickel, I am referring to the cornerback that takes the field on nickel sub-action. I'm referring to the third corner that takes the field on the depth chart. I know the coaches themselves and many people out there use the term nickel cornerback and slot cornerback interchangeably. And when they say nickel, they mean slot. I do not do that. As a quick tangent, you know, I think those two terms can mean the same thing, but don't automatically mean the same thing. I think, personally, I don't think it makes sense to refer to Robert Alford as the nickel cornerback if he's playing in the slot. You know, I think Isaiah Oliver might be playing outside, but he is the nickel cornerback in that scenario. That, you know, again, I'm not saying that my way is the right way, but it's the way that makes the most sense to me. But I digress. I think, you know, this is going to be an interesting battle. I think, you know, Oliver obviously has the long-term upside, so if it's close, it makes a lot of sense for the Falcons to sort of go with him over Poole, just because you have, you know, you can more quickly develop that potential with him. But I also think that just despite Oliver's upside and talent, I don't think, you know, it's a shoo-in that he's going to win the battle. I think there's a very strong possibility that Brian Poole will win that spot. And I think it's somewhat reminiscent, I think, with people's readiness to declare Duke Riley as the guy that was going to beat Devondre Campbell last year for that starting weak side spot and be the number two linebacker and the team's main linebacker beside Deion Jones. And I think, you know, this is another example of, I think, people underestimating how valuable NFL experience is and how important it is, and that transitioning to the NFL is not easy for a multitude of reasons. And, you know, you're moving to a new city, you're integrating a new locker room, integrating with new coaching staff, you got to learn a playbook, learn a scheme, you got to improve your technique. You go from being a big fish in a small pond to a small fish in a big pond for the most part. You know, you previously, your college team, almost always, most of these guys, and in particular a guy like Isaiah Oliver, was probably the most talented player on his team this past year. If not, you know, one, if he wasn't one, he was two, or whatever. And now he's going to go to an Atlanta team where he'll be lucky to be in the top 20 among the most talented players initially. And eventually he sort of rise up, as it were, and be, you know, that more of that high level player, but he's not going to be that guy day one and probably won't be that guy day 30 or whenever. So I do think, you know, when you consider all that and then throw on, if you're going to be the main nickel corner, that third corner, your first six games, you're going to go up against Alshon Jeffrey, Devin Funches, Michael Thomas, AJ Green, Antonio Brown, and DeSean Jackson. You know, good luck with that. You know, so I think it's not to say that Oliver doesn't have the talent to go toe-to-toe with those guys, particularly some of those guys as he gets more development in the league. But in terms of coming out of the gates and being that guy, you know, personally, I'm going to pump the brakes on those expectations to a certain extent. And I think, yeah, we did bring in Oliver to check some of these bigger guys, but I think maybe it's a little bit too much to think that he's going to come in and be that guy right away. You know, I think the expectation that he's going to, you know, come out right out of the gates and be comparable to what, you know, Desmond Trufant was as a rookie, as some people seem to be pushing that narrative or suggesting that narrative or implying that narrative by talking up Oliver's potential to impact early. I think I would pump the brakes a little bit on that. You know, I think, you know, if you look at Pro Football Focus grades over the last 5 years and look at rookie cornerbacks through their first like seven or so games, you know, Trufant has been one of the best guys. You know, you look at that list of guys that list at the top, it's Marshawn Lattimore in no particular order, Tre'Davious White, Ronald Darby, Honey Badger, Jason Verrett, and Trufant. And, you know, does Oliver have the talent to join that group? Absolutely. Will he? Well, you do the math on that, and that basically says if you're in that top five or six guys that I just mentioned, you're like in the 90th percentile. And what that means is basically, for, you know, oversimplification, but that basically means there's a 10% chance that you're in that group. Those guys are counted among your peers historically, and a 90% chance that you fall somewhere below that. So I think, you know, you can do the math and figure out which is the likelier outcome. Again, that's not to say that one outcome will or won't happen. I just think if you're being realistic, what's going to happen, he's probably going to fall somewhere below that. Now, the question is, where does he fall in that regard? I don't know, guys. I think he'll be good. But I think, you know, this is part of my whole issue with expectations. And part of the reason why I harp on, and not to go on too much of a rant here, but part of the reason why I so harp on expectations, not just to be miserable for the sake of being miserable, being negative for the sake of being negative, it's to save you guys from yourselves. And I think oftentimes, and you see somewhat of this with Oliver, you get on these hype trains, you know, particularly during the summer after the draft when you have no football to really talk about. And it's just about, you know, talking up how amazing this rookie or that rookie is going to be. And we've seen it with Jake Matthews. We've seen it with Vic Beasley. We've seen it with Jalen Collins and Tevin Coleman and Duke Riley, et cetera, et cetera. And these guys don't quite live up to their initial hype, and then it winds up being a backlash. And I don't think, you know, I don't think there's a correlation between, you know, or I do think there is a correlation between, you know, I don't think there's a coincidence between the fact that Austin Hooper was being called this breakout candidate last summer at this time last year. Oh, he's going to be a breakout star for the Falcons offense this year. And then the wide and popular perception there is now 12 months later, that he had a very disappointing 2017 season. I don't think, you know, it's weird to me that people are sort of oblivious to this sort of cycle where there's hype and then there's backlash when people don't live up to the hype. And then, you know, people are running these hype trains and leading these fans to these sort of unrealistic expectations. And then, you know, when fans then react to that and have this inevitable backlash that often comes, and then they say, oh, well, you guys were being ridiculous for, you know, thinking that this rookie was going to come in right away and be the star. And it's like, but you were saying it. And, you know, you see this phenomenon manifest in a lot of ways, including the players I mentioned earlier. But you saw this last offseason with Sark, and again, not to make this into a Sark thing, we're talking about cornerbacks. But it's like, you know, I'm a very vocal critic of Sark, but at the same time, I also acknowledge that Sark gets a lot of unfair criticism and is really being held to an impossibly high standard that was Kyle Shanahan in 2016. But I think one of the reasons why he's held to that standard is because people last offseason spent 7 months from February to August talking about how, you know, there was going to be no regression and any talk of regression is overhyped and the system's going to be the same, the playbook's going to be the same, the personnel's going to be the same, and Sark's going to be just fine. And then when he's not just fine, obviously, yeah, there's going to be a little bit of a visceral overreaction from certain elements. Maybe it's an overreaction, but obviously people are going to have a strong opinion about it because you were telling them for 7 months, it's going to be just fine, it's going to be great, and it's going to be wonderful, and then it's not, and then they're like, wait, I have some questions. And then you have the audacity to sit there and be like, well, you're just being unrealistic. And it's like, okay, sure. Again, don't want to make this into a Sark thing. Let's get back to Oliver. But I think, you know, as far as my expectations for what Oliver is going to be, right, my expectations is that he'll be good. My expectations of what the Falcons will do with Isaiah Oliver is what they did with Duke Riley last year, which is he will compete for playing time. He will work into the lineup. He won't be thrown to the Wolves right away because of the very murderer's row of wide receivers that are going to line up on that side of the field where he's lined up at right cornerback when Robert Alford kicks into the slot. If he's the third cornerback, it's one of those things where I think he's going to get opportunities. I think, like we saw with Duke Riley last year, getting reps alongside Devondre Campbell, where Devondre Campbell was getting the bulk of the nickel reps, but they would mix Duke Riley in there in the nickel as well as his responsibilities in the base defense. And I think you're going to see that with Oliver. I think some weeks maybe that will be two or three series where he gets to work in the nickel. I think maybe other weeks it might be 8 or 9 series or more. And that's going to depend on the matchups and certain matchups early in the season. You could sit there today and say, oh, it makes a lot more sense to put Isaiah Oliver in this game. Like, you know, I think Philadelphia is one of those. I think the Giants potentially and Steelers are potentially one of those matchups because in those instances, being the outside receiver, you know, in the Steelers game, as we talked about in a previous episode, in that situation, you're not putting him against Antonio Brown. You're asking Trufant to shadow Antonio Brown on the outside, and Oliver just basically cover James Washington or Justin Hunter or whoever that third wide receiver is, with Alford staying in the slot and covering Juju Smith-Schuster whenever the Falcons go nickel, where Juju primarily lines up in the slot for the Steelers. That to me is what makes the most sense in that specific matchup. But at the same time, I could understand why the Falcons are like, well, we're not going to have Trufant travel, and we want to get the maximum amount of times where either our best or second best corner, you know, Alford or Trufant, is on Antonio Brown, who's going to line up at that left wide receiver spot more often than not. And so we're going to put him there, and then we'll just trust Brian Poole to be able to keep Juju Smith-Schuster in check for the majority of the game, and maybe a series or two here or there. We might throw Oliver a bone and see what he does. And I think if he handles whatever those opportunities are early in the season, if he handles those well, then he will get more opportunities as the season wore on. Unfortunately for Duke Riley, he didn't necessarily take full advantage of those opportunities, and then he got hurt. And so we never really got to see that sort of developmental plan come to fruition as we may have hoped, or the coaching staff had hoped. And I think Oliver is in a unique position where you could be a little bit more optimistic, given that he's arguably more talented relative to his position than Duke Riley was. And, we'll have some unique opportunities early in the season to really potentially take advantage of. So I think that's, to me, those are my expectations for Isaiah Oliver in terms of running away with, you know, how great he can be. You know, that's a conversation we'll see. Like, call me crazy, but I'm just going to wait and see what he actually looks like on the field before I get too crazy on these hype trains. As for Brian Poole, what more do I have to say about Brian Poole? He's solid. I think, you know, my personal opinion about Brian Poole is I think he's a starting caliber safety that has been forced to various reasons. And primarily, you can argue, thanks to Jalen Collins and his knuckleheadness, has been forced to basically be a stopgap for the Falcons at nickel cornerback. And I think he's handled those responsibilities as well as you could have hoped for him to do so as an undrafted free agent that isn't necessarily as tall, fast, long, or athletic as you typically in this scheme would want in this scheme where the Falcons put a lot of insistence on man coverage, particularly on third downs. I think Poole has been varying degrees as a nickel cornerback above average, and sometimes very good in that role, and in some it depends on the matchup, which is one of the reasons why adding a player like Oliver does give you a lot more flexibility to sort of come at those matchups in different ways. But I don't think it suddenly means that Brian Poole's going to be completely written out of the situation. As I've said on previous episodes, you know, and this is speculation that I'm basing purely off of very flimsy circumstantial evidence, but I believe it. I think Marcon Manuel is a big fan of Brian Poole for various reasons. And I think there isn't necessarily going to be a rush by this coaching staff to push Brian Poole out of the lineup. I think they're going to use both Oliver and Poole to both of their advantage, which means basically now Brian Poole doesn't have to carry all of the heavy lifting of being the nickel cornerback and covering the slot. Now you can have Alford sort of taking some of that in certain games. That's going to be very meaningful. And then you don't necessarily have to have Isaiah Oliver come in and be this impact nickel, because Brian Poole's going to be able to take something off of his plate. That, to me, is the most sound strategy. That makes the most sense in my eyes. We'll see if the Falcons come to that. You know, if Oliver does live up to the hype, comes in right away and tears it up in the preseason, then that's, you know, then they can move forward and say, no, let's go full in on the Oliver train and you know, see what we can get out of this kid as soon as possible, as I said earlier. So we'll see what happens. But again, you know, my whole thing is I don't necessarily get the push to automatically go to that sort of level 11 or whatever you want to call it, where the best case scenario is going to happen as quickly as other people are. So we'll see what happens. Now we'll wrap up talking about the team's top two corners in Desmond Trufant and Robert Alford. But I do want to plug Locked On Braves podcast with Nabias Fulborn, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day. So, you know, I'll try not to go on another rant here a little bit about expectations. I tend to go on these rants too much. I got a lot of pent up frustration, guys. These podcasts are my therapist. So, you know, I hope you're happy to be, you know, my silent therapist working for free. I don't have a ton to say about Alford and Trufant. I don't think there's a lot that needs to be said about him. It's comparable to, you know, the first position review where I didn't, you know, I spent what, like a minute talking about Matt Ryan. There's not a whole lot to talk about. You know what he is. But apparently there's this thing within our fan base, and I don't get it. I mean, you know, where you have to have a take on Alford versus Trufant. And for some reason you can't like both of those players. One of them is better than the other. You know, my personal opinion is they're both good. I think if you're asking me who has played better as of late, I think Alford has played better than Trufant over the last 2 years, in part because Trufant missed half of a season, and so two is greater than one and a half. You know, two good seasons versus one and a half is greater. So I don't think there's really a whole lot topic debate there. I think if you're asking me who is the better guy, as in, like, who I think over the next 2 years is going to outplay the other player, or who, if I was a GM of a team, I would choose over the other first. If I was, you know, if they were both in the same draft, who would I draft first? I think Trufant's the better guy. The reasons I think that is I think Trufant is more technically sound. I think he plays with better awareness. I think he's more consistent snap to snap. I think he's more physical, at least as far as run support goes, snap to snap. I think, you know, in terms of physicality and coverage, I think Alford's better at that. But I think Alford has a tendency to take a play or two off here or there when in run support. And it, you know, it leads to some vulnerabilities. And one of the reasons why the Falcons aren't as consistently good against the run as they probably could be. Not to sort of put that all on Alford, but it's noticeable when he's not setting the edge and he's not attacking his block. You know, when Mark Ingram rips off a 15-yard run, when if he had done his job on that play, it probably would have only been a 5-yard run or something like that. So, you know, I get why there's a tendency for, you know, fans to sort of throw one or both of these guys under the bus to a certain extent. I think it's part of the nature of when you're only watching the secondary play based off of the television live on Sunday and you don't have access to watching the All-22, you don't get a complete picture of what's going on in the secondary. And as I've discussed in previous episodes, this is where the sort of the splash plays become king. And particularly with the secondary, when you only have a handful of plays that are can be considered as splash plays, whether positively or negatively, it can really sort of skew perceptions of people. And, you know, on the positive side, you have interceptions, but interceptions only really happen on about 2 to 3% of all passes, which is a very low percentage. You're talking about, You know, when you're talking about pass breakups, even for your top cornerbacks, on average, they're maybe only averaging one or so of those a game. So you're only really going to get one positive play every now and then. When it comes to, you know, you might get one interception on average per game. So, you know, and then it's really about opportunity when it comes to who's going to get that one interception on average. And then when you, on the negative side, you talk about, you know, quote unquote, getting burnt or whatever, but giving up big plays, where typically in an NFL game, you're going to give up, you know, any team is going to give up 3 to 5 big plays over the course of a game. And typically those are going to go to your outside wide receivers. And so therefore your outside quarterbacks are going to be most vulnerable to giving up those types of plays. And so that's part of the reason why I always say, you know, getting beat as a is part of playing quarterback in the NFL. The average NFL quarterback is going to throw 35 passes. He's going to complete 62% of those, which means in your typical NFL game, each team is going to complete at least 20, 21, 22 passes over the course of that game on average. And again, he's not throwing those against air. So someone's going to have to give up those 20 to 22 completions over the course of that game. And so what winds up happening is typically what separates a good secondary from a bad secondary is their good secondary's ability to take away a couple of those completions. And it may be just 2 or 3 of those completions. And a good secondary may, instead of giving up 5 big plays in a game, may only give up 3. And it's those little nuances and subtle differences between what's good and what's bad, which is lost by and large, I think, when most people are just watching the game live on Sunday on television, that you really need to watch the film to really understand those nuances. And so I get why people tend to sort of overreact when it comes to Trufant and Alford, when it comes to the penalties, when it comes to the touchdown that he allowed against that guy, that, you know, oh no, he's the worst. And it's like, yeah, I get why people do it. Or let me rephrase that. I get how that happens. I understand the mechanism for why that happens, but I don't necessarily get why it happens. If you can understand the difference, I don't understand why people don't like both guys. I don't understand why people look at those guys and don't see one of the best cornerback duos in the league. I don't see why people don't look at the secondary and those two guys being a huge part of that secondary, and why the secondary is so good as the secondary as being the sort of the key part of the Falcons team. I think the secondary is the strongest part of the Falcons entire roster. We, you know, you see people talking about how great and talented the Falcons roster is and whatnot. And the secondary to me is far and away the best part of the roster. And I don't quite get why people still feel compelled to then go after some of these players in the secondary, whether it's Alford, whether it's Trufant, whether it's either one of the safety, whether it's Brian Poole. Like, I have myself have been critical of Brian Poole from time to time, but I do recognize, and part of the reason why I'm not as sort of quick to throw him under the bus, is that he is a core part of that secondary and a core part of their success. I just think he could probably be better utilized if the Falcons, as they have done this offseason with the selection of Isaiah Oliver, continue to supplement and address that secondary in specific ways. And I think with the Alford and Trufant thing, you sort of see, you're seeing it now and you have seen it in the past, in regards to how people talk about Devontae Freeman and Tevin Coleman. It seems like, again, people seem to draw up these sides and draw this line and say, you're either Devontae Freeman guy or you're a Tevin Coleman guy, and there's no in between. And it's like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, there was once upon a time, particularly early in the 2016 season, where I would have been just as eager to fight people about on my take that Devontae Freeman is a much better running back than Tevin Coleman, and if you think otherwise, you're crazy, blah, 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 blah. Like, yeah, I thought that then, but now, as time has worn on, I've learned to appreciate both of those players, and I love both of those players, and I want both of those players to be Falcons for as long as they are. I don't understand this tendency that people want to run these guys out of town. You're going to see, like, I'm already warning you now, and we've talked about this when we broke down the running back position, that this is going to be the summer of Ito. If Ito Smith has a good summer, you're going to see people having takes going into September talking about, we should trade Devontae Freeman, or we should trade Tevin Coleman. Look at how great Ito Smith is doing. And I think this is part of the reason why I think there's some of this Oliver hype a little bit. Again, not to suggest that Oliver isn't deserving of people being optimistic about his potential and future. I just don't think that you necessarily need to, the ceiling is enormously high. the floor doesn't necessarily have to, we don't have to start the floor on the third story of the house, guys. We can start it at the, you know, at ground level before we start climbing up the, you know, the different floors here. If you get my metaphor. And like, I think part of the whole Alfred versus Truth, or part of the Oliver hype, I'm sorry, has to deal with sort of people and their desire to want to push one of these guys out the door. And so they're kind of like, oh, Isaiah Oliver is going to be really good, and therefore we can get rid of Trufant, or we can get rid of Alford because hot takes or whatever. And so I think there's a little bit of an ulterior motive here. And so that's part of the reason why I'm like, hey, let's pump the brakes a little bit here, because I think you're pushing this narrative, not because you really believe it, but you have an ulterior motive here. Just a little bit. Maybe I'm being paranoid there, but that's sort of how I feel about this cornerback position. That's how I feel about Alford and Trufant. They're both great. You're more than welcome to think one is better than the other, just like you're more than welcome to think either Devontae Freeman or Tevin Coleman's better. But like the whole like one of them is good and one of them is bad, or let's build up one, and part of the way that we build up one is to tear down the other guy, I don't think makes sense. And when I gave my assessment of why I think Trufant's better, I hoped it wasn't necessarily with the idea of tearing down Alford. I think Alford is really good. You know, he's got the length, he's got the physicality, he's got better ball skills in terms of his ability to attack the ball and make plays on it. Let me say make plays on the ball, to be clear there. And with his length, you know, he reasonably does well against some of the bigger targets he faces, and he has that good straight line speed. So it's one of those things where like you can appreciate both players and understand that there are differences between them. That's how I sort of feel about it. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what those two guys do. I'm looking forward to seeing what the rest of the secondary does. We'll talk about the safeties tomorrow. I'll give some of the reasons again why I think this safety group, particularly Keanu Neal, don't get enough credit from this fan base. Because again, for partially due to the reasons I outlined, where people tend to overrate, you know, one negative play here or there, but that's something we can talk about on tomorrow's episode. Until then, you can provide any feedback that you want to give on this podcast or the Falcons or whatever on Twitter. I'm at FalcFans. If it's podcast related, just go ahead and send it over to Locked On Falcons. That's the show's Twitter handle. You can also check us out on Facebook at Locked On Falcons. Email address is lockedonfalcons@mail.com. And of course, you can leave a comment at lockedonfalcons.com or falcfans.com, where the show is posted daily. So yeah, that's it, guys, on the quarterback group. This is a really solid group. You know, the top four guys are really good. The back two or three, you know, I'm a little skeptical of, but one hopes that we won't see very much of any of those guys on defense at the very least. They can kill it on special teams for all I care this year. And if that's the case, then I think there's going to be a lot of good things for this Falcons defense, and particularly the secondary. So until then.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
As I was editing this podcast, I realized I completely blanked on one corner. There's eight corners in camp. It's Deontay Burton. And I forget because sometimes he's still listed on wherever website you say as a wide receiver as opposed to a cornerback. He made this position switch last year when he was put on the practice squad. It'll be interesting to see what Burton does this year. I'm very eager to see him because we haven't really seen him as a cornerback. And so, you know, if he's going to be CJ Goodwin experiment 2.0, and whether or not long term, we saw very early flashes from CJ Goodwin, and one of the reasons why he was able to stick as long as he was, and, you know, I would argue probably still should be on the Falcons roster at the very least, to at least compete for a role. But we'll see if Deontay Burton can sort of, you know, show a little bit more ability, more upside. He's got the size, he's got the length. We'll see what he does. And I think, you know, that'll be another storyline to watch early in camp. I apologize for blanking on Deontay Burton and his potential to impact in training camp. And, you know, I think because of what I said earlier, I think he's pretty a long shot to make the team. But I do think that he certainly has a better than average chance potentially of potentially landing on the practice squad. Just because I think the Falcons like to have somebody development awaiting in the wings, like we saw with CJ Goodwin a couple of years ago and others. So we'll see what Burton does. So there you have it, guys. I hope you're one of those people that stays to the end, all the way to the end, to listen to the podcast. Otherwise, someone's going to tweet me like, what about Deontay Burton? And I'm like, you didn't listen. Clearly, you don't listen to the entire podcast.